Our founding fathers gathered to enjoy lively political conversation over a local brew, and so do we. It's Pints and Politics, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Yesterday evening, we gathered at CSPS in Cedar Rapids to talk politics with columnists Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, and Adam Sullivan, as well as political reporter James Lynch. My co-host was Aaron Jordan. From Kavanaugh and control of Congress to the Reynolds-Hubbell race, less than a month before midterms. Pints and Politics, just ahead. First, this news. Our founding fathers gathered in taverns to enjoy lively political conversation over a local brew, and so do we. It's a special Pints and Politics edition of River to River, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. Today, coming to you from CSPS in Cedar Rapids, I'm Ben Kiefer.
And I am Aaron Jordan.
Welcome.
I'd like to introduce our panelists here. We've got Todd Dorman, Gazette Insights Editor, Linda Waddington, Gazette columnist, Jim Lynch, our political reporter for the Gazette, and Adam Sullivan, our Gazette columnist.
Let's hear it for our panelists. We're going to start off with the national political scene, right, Aaron?
Yes, that's right. We have a lot of questions, so I'll get right to it. So last Saturday, Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed for the U.S. Supreme Court. Judge Kavanaugh's testimony was very passionate, and I wondered whether you think this is going to have any ramifications for the perception that the nation's highest court is nonpartisan.
I think that ship has sailed years ago. I think that's already... But certainly his testimony highlights that issue even more. There were concerns that he was more or less outwardly partisan during his most recent testimony. I read today that Chief Justice John Roberts has referred some complaints about that testimony to the 10th District, I believe. I don't think they necessarily have any teeth as far as an impeachment process or whatever, which I don't think would be appropriate. But there are complaints about him that are at least being looked into right now.
I think it was a case of somebody just like maybe coming in too hot, you know, like I want to be, passionate, but he had it dialed past 10 and it really worked against him. I mean, because he did come across as very partisan, very angry, and which doesn't really seem to fit with his demeanor otherwise.
Did his apology column make it any better?
Maybe marginally, a tenth of a point or something.
I think it was not a very forceful explanation. He didn't really backtrack. He kind of hinted that it was inappropriate. But if you're trying to make the point that you're not a partisan, why would you go to the most conservative editorial page in the country to make that case?
He's certainly not the first justice to be appointed who worked a great deal in politics and was sort of in partisan positions. But I generally think it's just a bad idea to nominate people that have been so deeply, working in politics. I mean, he worked for Ken Starr, he worked in the Bush administration. I mean, a lot of his background was political. He was able to sort of diffuse that until the sexual assault allegation came up, and then he sort of ripped the mask off and was again this sort of partisan player. I mean, accusing the Clintons of a conspiracy against him and all of these other things. And I don't think you can put the mask back on. And that's going to be the problem going forward, is because the groups that were allied against him are going to at some point have cases before this court. And if he, how is he taking part in that? And, if they rule against these groups, I mean, it's definitely a grounds for crying foul, but they're right, though. The court's been partisan. We've had decisions, Bush v. Gore would be one that immediately jumps to mind. So, but it just would be nice if presidents looked for all of the dozens of jurists out there who have, spent their time working in law and academia and that have these sort of more less political careers, conservative nonetheless, but just not people who were political operatives or worked for special prosecutors asking other presidents about, you know, blue dresses and whatnot. So,
I also think this is a case of you reap what you sow. In the case that Democrats didn't complain when Democrats were changing the majority needed to confirm justices. Then you had Republicans who upped the ante and applied it to Supreme Court justices. You know, I think we all need to look around and really look at ourselves and our partisan bias and say, are we doing things that are harmful to our country? And I think after this debacle, we can definitely say that yes, we are.
Well, I would also say that after this debacle, it raises the question of whether another Supreme Court justice can get confirmed if the Senate stays relatively evenly split like it is now. You know, I don't know. 50-48 isn't very, you know, isn't a ringing endorsement, a ringing confirmation for Justice Kavanaugh. And I mean, the next nomination is just going to be another dumpster fire. A magnitude of 10 compared to this.
You know, I just want to add one more piece to this discussion. When we were in the Amanas at Millstream Brewing, and we were talking about this next nomination coming up, I was the member of the panel who said they should go forward with this nomination. They should hold hearings. What happened with Merrick Garland was just simply wrong. But you can't fix a wrong with another wrong. So I wanted this to go forward. I wanted it to be a fair hearing. But the bottom line was, this was a man who was unfit for the Supreme Court, and he should not have been confirmed.
I wanted to touch briefly on some comments made by Senator Chuck Grassley. So he's joined some other Republicans, including President Trump, by saying he tended to believe that some of the vocal protesters were paid by liberal billionaire George Soros. So the Washington Post had a fact check on that earlier this week, and they said this was more of a conspiracy theory than fact. They gave it 3 out of 5 Pinocchios, which means it's less true. Do you think Grassley would have made a statement like that 10 years ago? And if you were advising him, would you suggest he walk that back?
I don't know about the protesters he's talking about, but there are groups like Next Gen who are paying a lot of what they call field directors, but who are going out and attending demonstrations, things like that. They're not paid to protest. They're paid to be political organizers. But part of their job is to get other people to come to these protests. They've been active in Iowa City, where I live. And I don't know that there was, and it happens on the right and the left, there's all these outside grassroots groups that pay young people to go do political organizing. I'm not sure that it was happening to the same extent 10 years ago. And so I think that gives rise to a lot of these ideas about paid protesters.
Well, and what does Chuck Grassley have against the free market? I mean, if...
I want to come back to what you're saying, Adam, though. You know, the women, like especially the two women who confronted Jeff Flake, they were talking about their own personal experience with sexual assault. I mean, if they're getting paid, did they get paid to make up those stories? You know, I guess I just don't, I'm not sure. Just because maybe they're from an organization that gets money from Soros, I'm not sure about that.
No, I don't. In that specific case, I don't have any reason to believe that there was money changing hands in that. But I think, I think Grassley's statement was probably out of line. But there are a lot of people being paid to participate in politics.
Well, and it's, it's just meant to discredit, you know, the protests. I mean, as they're saying, there were people paid to organize, and they did organize actual people who weren't paid. So that's how protests work. And the Democrats can throw out the Koch brothers, and Chuck Grassley can throw out George Soros, and they're speaking to their base and getting people whipped up because those are names that make people angry on their side of the spectrum. So it's kind of a partisan game that we're playing now.
So is anyone else in the audience thinking what I am? That I've been involved in Iowa politics for over 20 years and I've never once got a paycheck for squat?
You know, always the women.
It is. Because, you know, the women are out there and they're actually fighting day after day, and we don't get paid for it. And And Senator Grassley, and I haven't heard this quote, I haven't seen the context of this quote, but if he was referring to the women who came to Capitol Hill to describe how they were sexually assaulted, Senator Grassley should be ashamed.
It's a special edition of River to River, Pints and Politics, a live event recorded at CSPS in Cedar Rapids for a audience of a couple hundred at least. Listening to our panelists, Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, Adam Sullivan, and James Lynch of the Gazette, Aaron Jordan, my co-host, I'm Ben Kiefer, and plenty of great questions for us. Aaron, continuing on the Kavanaugh discussion, how many in the audience clap if you watched some or most of the hearings or listened to it? So this hasn't happened since, for certainly a judicial hearing, since Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas, right? Where does this leave the Me Too movement? This takes place in the course of a movement that's been going on for several months, if not a year. Does this mark a turning point in the Me Too movement, especially with now the reaction of President Trump in what was the quote saying is a very scary time for young men or men? I'm baiting you, Linda.
So I know you are. So let me do this. Just for the radio audience, all the men in the audience clap. Now, all the men who have been falsely accused of sexual harassment or sexual assault, clap. It's dark. Okay, also for the audience, women, or for those who are listening, women in the audience, please clap. How many of you have been a victim of sexual harassment or sexual assault? You know, there's this idea, and it's a backlash to the Me Too movement, that men are very much in danger of being falsely accused of misbehaving, and it's simply not true. You know, we can see it when we get into groups of people and we start honestly asking our friends and neighbors, well, have you ever been accused? No, well, I haven't been accused, but the danger is out there. You know, the real danger are women out in society that are having their behinds grabbed, who are getting catcalled, and all of these things that have been happening for decades. And we are just now starting to talk about it as a culture. You know, and I'm sorry that the president thinks that on one day he can find testimony credible, and on the next day he can mock that same testimony. By the way, testimony that said the one thing she will never forget is being mocked by the people who attacked her. And whether or not you believe that was Brett Kavanaugh or somebody else, it doesn't matter. That's the one thing she remembered. And for her trouble of coming forward because she thought it was the right thing to do, she now has the President of the United States mocking her. So going back to the original question, what does this do to the Me Too movement? It means that every one of us who have ever had something horrible happen need to become even more vocal. And we need to be very insistent that when women claim sexual harassment, less than 2% are found to be non-credible. Less than 2%. Believe women.
Well, I want to shift gears to President Trump's visit this week to Council Bluffs. So the big news when the president came to the state is that he's directed the EPA to allow year-round use of E15, which is fuel with 15% ethanol. So right now it's not allowed to be used during the summer because of concerns about pollution. How big of a deal is this switch in Iowa, the year-round use of E15?
As a practical matter, for you know, for the economic boost that it might provide to agriculture, I'd say it's not a huge thing. There's still, so in Iowa, there's only 166 gas stations that are set up for E15, and I imagine that we're higher than most other states. So a lot of stations aren't even set up to do this. But I would say, as a political matter, I think Republicans in Iowa have been trying to show that they have the president's ear, that you know they endorse this guy forcefully, and that they want that to be worth something. So Congressman Blum and Senators Grassley and Ernst, that's been a priority of theirs, and so they can take this and say, we have a big win, that we influenced the president and got what Iowa wanted done.
During the president's visit, he also had on stage with him David Young, along with other GOP candidates here. And he linked a vote for local candidates to him. And I wonder if anybody on the panel perceives sort of a change from, you know, the first year of the Trump presidency to now, if our GOP congressional officials now are more likely or less hesitant to link their futures to this president.
Well, I think it, to some degree, it depends on, you know, the situation. The people who were in Council Bluffs were the president's base, who probably are David Young's base and Kim Reynolds' base and Steve King's base. So, you know, they're safe being linked there.
Well, and in Iowa, most of the Republican leaders and most of the office holders, clung so tightly to Donald Trump when he ran for election in 2016 and gave him such full-throated support. For them to try to back away now, I don't think would work anyway. I think they're so closely tied to him that's just...
With one exception, isn't Senator Grassley an exception there? Don't I remember a campaign appearance where he did not appear on stage with Donald Trump?
And that was right about that.
When others joined Donald Trump on stage as the nominee, Chuck Grassley did not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true, although... You know, especially now after the Kavanaugh saga, I think he's probably closer to the president than he has been in the last few years. So
the other thing is, Chuck Grassley really doesn't need Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. You know, he's been elected, you know, since 1958 or whatever, and without Donald Trump, he doesn't need him. So he doesn't need to appear on the stage. He doesn't need to glad hand the president in the way that maybe other candidates feel they need the president's support.
Just kind of piggybacking on Adam's comment about retailers, how few are set up for the E15 capacity. I know that was one point that Fred Hubble made in the debate last night, said something about providing incentives to retailers to offer E15. I mean, I don't know whether that just kind of went over like a non-issue, or do you think whether that's a legitimate point, or will that come up again?
I'm not surprised that Fred Hubble wants to have a giveaway for businesses to do something he wants them to do. I don't know how realistic it is. I understand there's already some incentive to offer higher ethanol blends, because then you can get involved with the waivers that refineries buy, but very complicated. I don't necessarily think that's a top of mind issue for voters or for politicians to incentivize E15 retail, but this announcement is very recent, so we'll see how it shakes out.
Well, when E85 started, the state created a pretty big incentive program to try to get, because that involves some fairly significant infrastructure changes to gas stations to you know, have the tanks and things that could carry a blend that high. I don't know what the infrastructure costs are for E15, but Republicans and Democrats have traditionally supported those kind of programs to help fuel retailers adapt to that, but it's always a question of how many fuel retailers want to actually sell that product. And with the 85, it took a really long time to get retailers interested in selling it. They weren't sure how many people would want to buy it, and I think that's still a problem for E85.
But the whole discussion is kind of disingenuous, because while Trump is out there saying he's going to do year-round E15, at the same time his EPA department is granting waivers so people don't have to blend ethanol. It's great to say that you're going to do this year round, but you also have to have the capacity to do it. And right now, we simply don't because of these waivers.
Well, and the details haven't even, with the E15 thing, haven't been worked out yet.
Right.
And this is an administration that is kind of known for saying one thing one day and then 6 months later. So, I mean, that's always a question.
The E15 gift that the president was bearing when he came to Iowa earlier this week is tied to, well, the commodity prices, corn, hoping to keep those prices up. We've had a very aggressive trade policy from the president, which is, I think, acknowledged by all quarters as depressing some commodity prices. What about the recent U.S., Canada, and Mexico trade agreement to replace NAFTA, called NAFTA 2.0, or goes by the acronym USMCA? Major changes on cars, new policies on labor, environmental standards, intellectual property protections, some digital trade provisions. Doesn't the president deserve some credit there for taking NAFTA, improving it, despite a lot of criticism over the last year when he really went against the grain here?
As hard as it is to say, yeah, he probably does deserve some credit, because, I mean, it's an agreement, what is it, 24 years old. It probably needed to be updated. There are a lot of people who saw needs to, you know, sort of redefine this agreement in light of the changes in economy, in light of changes in the products we're trying to export. I'm not sure that this is really a big change from NAFTA. It tweaks some things here and there, but it's not, I'm not even sure it's 2.0. It's more like 1.7 or something like that. I think the big prize out there, though, is restoring trade relations with China.
And also, it doesn't deal with the metal tariffs, which Mexico, after we did that, slapped pork tariffs on us. That drives down demand for pork, which drives down demand for corn and soybeans that you feed to hogs. And so these issues are all very well connected. And I think the Trump administration, at least the president himself, did not have a very good understanding of, you know, if you tip the scale at one point over here, that there's all of these other consequences. And now that we're getting into our first harvest season under the very aggressive trade restrictions, I think that's what you're going to want to see, you know, when these farmers have to store their commodities because you can't get a good price for them, that really hurts folks. So I think the rubber meets the road here pretty quick.
The United Nations released a report this week saying the world will start experiencing effects of climate change, food shortages, more wildfires, more rapid death of the coral reefs by 2040. Thinking about this allowing of E15 year-round, which before it had been a pollution issue, under the Trump administration, I don't know, Todd, you may have a handle on this. What sort of incremental changes has the Trump EPA made that may be setting us back in terms of the environment?
Well, I mean, the EPA doesn't like to talk about climate change. They've sort of pulled back things online, and they've cautioned their scientists, and scientists have left the EPA because they feel like there are restrictions on their research. They've even in the Pentagon for years sort of prepared for, you're going to have, with climate change, you're going to have displaced populations, you're going to have conflict. The Pentagon has planned for that. Now that's no longer on their priority list since the Trump administration came into fore. I just hope that this climate change debate ends in time for us to, do something about climate change, because that seems to be their line, is that there's still this debate and that scientists don't agree and we don't know what to do. I think maybe the worse it gets, maybe the easier it is for them to say, well, we're doomed anyway, so why don't we go ahead and help the fossil fuel industry and keep burning coal, because, what difference does it make? It makes a lot of difference, because this UN report shows, we're at the point where, a degree and a half, which is bad enough. If we can avoid going to two, we can avoid, displacing hundreds of millions of people. If you thought the wars for oil were bad, what about the wars for water and food? I think those will probably be worse. But the Trump administration isn't terribly interested in it. The Republicans, for the most part, with a few exceptions, aren't that interested. So on a policy side, I don't know what's going to happen to mitigate, which is what we need.
Well, I think we're going to take a break now here at CSPS in Cedar Rapids. Ben Kiefer with my co-host in this situation, Aaron Jordan of the Gazette, James Lynch, Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, Adam Sullivan. It's a Pints and Politics edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment. And we're back with more of this special edition of River to River, Pints and Politics, coming to you as a recorded conversation before a live audience at CSPS in Cedar Rapids. Aaron Jordan is my co-host. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're here with political reporter James Lynch, columnists Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, and Adam Sullivan of the Gazette, and a wonderful audience of political junkies, all with mostly pints in hand.
I wanted to start off with the first gubernatorial debate, which was last night. For an hour, Governor Kim Reynolds and Democratic challenger Fred Hubble faced off on a variety of issues, including Medicaid privatization, tax credits, and what each thinks of the other's attack ads. As I was watching the debate, I was really looking forward to asking you, each of you, an important question, and one of our audience members had the same question. Who won the debate?
Well, within minutes, both campaigns had put out statements saying their candidate won. So, there you go.
I'll take Jake Porter.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Libertarian.
Yeah, you know, lots of attention for not being on stage.
He really did. And I think he showed a lot of class by not being up there trying to disrupt anything. He just went, sat in the audience, and...
Is that the standard now? Just don't disrupt it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm so used to it that it's shocking when
it doesn't
happen.
He didn't throw anything. He didn't yell. It was a civics lesson.
It was nice.
As far as who won, I mean, I would love to watch a debate and say the people of Iowa won, but I haven't seen that one yet. But, you know, I think they both, you know, did the job they needed to do and get the points across. I thought Kim Reynolds performed very well for having not been in that situation before. She hasn't debated on the big stage, either as lieutenant governor or as candidate for governor. So I don't think anybody was convinced to switch sides or independents are going to all, you know, stampede to the other, to one or the other. I'm actually looking forward after this first debate where they kind of size each other up. I'm hoping that the next two debates are a little more interesting and maybe a little more substantive.
What about these points about Medicaid privatization started by Governor Branstad, handed off to Governor Reynolds? That was a debate point. How did the two candidates come off on that, the criticism by Fred Hubble of the way that the privatization, the management privatization has gone?
Well, I think it's hard for Governor Reynolds to defend what's happening to people who are losing benefits or paying more, and Fred Hubble has been very good at finding examples of that. The example he used last night of somebody who had to go to a nursing home, which was more expensive than in-home care, and, you know, I mean, listening to legislative debates for years, that's one of the things they really cherish or really prize, is the idea of people staying in their home as long as they can. I don't know that, I don't think Governor Reynolds is ever going to win on Medicaid, but the problem for Fred Hubble is he really doesn't have a good plan, or at least he can't explain what he's going to do to fix it. He says, well, we're going to bring it back under state control. Well, I mean, really, it is under state control. I mean, they hired private companies to manage it. So it's like he has half change sort of answers that, you know, we're going to bring it under state control. Well, what's that going to do? Is that going to make it more expensive or less expensive? Is the service going to be better? We don't know those things. And it's a losing argument for her, but so far it just doesn't seem like it's a winning argument for him.
Well, and I think he missed an opportunity. He was given the chance to ask her a question. He sort of got mired up in this story where she's received some small, well, you know, a couple $1,000 campaign contributions from these managed care companies, which doesn't look particularly good. But on the spectrum of things that are wrong with this saga, I'm not sure that's the question that I would have asked. I mean, I think he could have been asking on our behalf and ask more about, you know, are we saving any money or not, which was the entire reason we did this to some extent. But by the same token, he met with our editorial board the other day. I think he's talking about, you know, his plan, I guess. I don't know if it's not detailed, but he's talking about probably what we should have done in the first place, which is get a lot of people together who are affected by the Medicaid program, who providers and clients and groups and lawmakers from both sides of the aisle, and talk about what we should do, and maybe, you know, instead of just doing it unilaterally with some sort of executive action without talking to any of those people, and then not sort of keeping the entire program under a managed care, you know, organizations, and looking at, you know, what pieces of the Medicaid program would be best under managed care and what pieces of it would be best under state management. I think sort of a hybrid plan. I think that could, you know, could improve the program, but I mean, the fact remains that we've got this privatization effort that was done, as I said, without without buy-in. And when you do something without buy-in and something goes wrong, that's part of Governor Reynolds' problem, is that there's no one to turn to. There are no allies to turn to. This, her administration, the Branstad administration, they own this. And so, I mean, I think even if she wins, eventually they're going to have to look at what Fred Hubbell is talking about, bringing parts of this program under a different brand of management than what it's under now.
What about this point, away from policy, but to the candidate transparency that came up in the debate between Governor Reynolds and Fred Hubbell about tax returns? Here we have sort of a flip side of what we're seeing on the national debate, where Governor Reynolds has given, 10 years of back tax returns? Fred Hubbell has provided the cover of his 2017 tax return. So will that make a difference? Let me ask the audience, in the future, going forward, how many would be in favor, whether you're the presidential candidate or a gubernatorial candidate? Let's say you must reveal 10 years of your tax returns.
I'd like to hear the opposite of that for our
okay.
audience.
Okay, let's, those who think that is a bad idea.
So Iowa's economy came up several times during the debate, with Reynolds talking about the state's record low unemployment and an anticipated budget surplus of $127 million. You know, Fred Hubbell kind of countering that, he said, well, the budget has been unpredictable with massive cuts happening and then the state discovers a surplus. Is that unpredictability a major problem that Fred Hubbell can hang his hat on, or does he not? I'm trying to see if you think that's a big point that he's drawing there.
So what I think, I want to go back to the tax returns very quickly. It's a point that I made before, but I'm going to keep making it again and again and again, so you guys can just plug your ears if you've heard it before. But if you're willing, because of your partisan bias, to overlook it for your candidate, you need to be willing to overlook it for candidates in the opposite party in the future. You know, if it's okay once, politicians understand that if it's been allowed once, that they can take advantage of that in the future.
By the way, Kim Reynolds said during the debate that she thinks Donald Trump should have released his taxes. I hadn't heard that before. She hasn't been really loud about it, but now she's on the record. Everyone's heard it that she thinks that. Fred Hubbell has had no good explanation for why he won't release his taxes. He says the documents he's put out so far are good enough, but he wouldn't even say last night whether he thought Donald Trump should release his taxes, because it's an issue he doesn't want to talk about.
Wouldn't it be great if Kim Reynolds had said that before the 2016 election?
To Aaron's question, I do think that makes a difference. I think it's not any one thing. I think it's 2 years worth of headlines about how the budget's not in good shape, and then a few headlines about how the budget's in great shape. I think most Iowans don't understand the details of that. I don't necessarily understand the details of that, but it does kind of cast this shadow of confusion and instability over state management.
And does instability mean it's harder to budget? I mean, you don't know if you can spend this money because you're not sure whether the surplus is going to come through, or?
Well, that's the problem of the past few years. There's the Revenue Estimating Council conference or whatever. They project the revenue. They haven't done a spectacular job of being accurate. And I'm not sure if that's their fault or the economy just doesn't perform as stably as it once did. It makes it harder to budget. It makes you have these swings back and forth. You have mid-year budget cuts, and then you have a surplus at the end of the year. So, I mean, the one thing it does is it gives every politician something to either hang their hat on or to complain about.
Well, and one good example of the problem that they have is that in 2013 they did a property tax reform package and backfilled the local governments and credits, and I mean that's almost a $300 million annual cost. So you have just an amount of new revenue that comes into the state, and you have to immediately take that $300 million off every time. That just reduces your margins, so that then if the REC gets your revenue estimates wrong, it erases that margin, and they've had to do mid-year budget cuts. I don't know what happens now that they've done a the $2 billion tax cut package that ramps up over the next several years. There's talk about rolling that backfill back for the property taxes. I don't want to get too far into the tax weeds, but we have this situation where revenues are a little bit unpredictable, but also your new revenue amounts are fairly small, and we keep sort of passing these tax initiatives that reduce the revenues further. The margins are going to get even smaller, and you're going to see more of this volatility where they can't, even if the prediction is near accurate, it's still not accurate enough, and it's going to blow a hole, and then you have to do budget cuts and revisions and things like that. So the more you cut taxes, the more you reduce your revenue. I mean, that's sort of easy to figure out. And so if you're having a hard time covering your priorities, education, healthcare, all of these things, you might want to stop doing that. But they're not going to stop doing that because politically it's advantageous to do it. So the more you reduce your revenues, the more revenue problems you're going to have. I mean, that's fairly simple.
I would just say, as an aside to what Todd said, is not every tax cut does reduce revenue. And that's every politician we've talked to this cycle agrees that some tax credits end up doing all these other things. Even Fred Hubble likes a lot of the tax credits.
If you just joined us on Iowa Public Radio, this is Pints and Politics, a special edition of River to River, an event recorded Thursday evening at CSPS in Cedar Rapids. Ben Kiefer with my co-host Aaron Jordan of the Gazette, James Lynch, Todd Dorman, Adam Sullivan, Linda Waddington of the Gazette on our panel, and an enthusiastic audience here at CSPS in Cedar Rapids. Well, we are in the first district. It would be remiss of us to not talk about the debate between Abby Finkenauer and the incumbent, Rod Blum, October 5th in town up the river on the Cedar Falls. We're in Cedar Rapids. Let's talk a little bit about that. We have a question here from one of our audience members. This person says, I think Abby Finkenauer has been very effective debating Rod Blum. Does the panel agree?
I think she was. I didn't really learn anything from the debate. There was no new, breakthroughs in terms of what they're going to do. The one thing I was a little bit surprised at is both of these people can be pretty sharp in their comments about the other, and they seem to maintain their manners through the debate for the most part. It'll be interesting. They debate again next Tuesday night. We'll see if they can remain well-behaved in the second round.
I only watched a few minutes, and I read quite a bit of the coverage afterwards, but I would agree with James that these candidates, it's similar to the gubernatorial race in some extent, but their talking points are very well-honed already over the past few months. The lines of attack they're going to take, we've already seen in their mailings, in their TV commercials. So the debates, I don't think, really changed the dynamic of that race very much.
I wanted to follow up. One of the points that was drawn there in that debate was there was some question of Finkenauer not immediately disclosing that she was working for a nonprofit that works for equal pay, family leave, and affordable child care. And then Representative Blum is under investigation by the House Ethics Committee for failing to disclose his involvement in a Dubuque marketing firm. Are these two allegations on par? How big of a deal is disclosure becoming?
Well, I guess you could judge the candidates based on the companies that they have conflict of interest with. I mean, you've got equal pay and family leave, and then you've got trying to hide FDA reports from the public. I mean, as conflicts go, we could judge them on that. That's, but I don't know that they're on equal foot. I mean, the ethics investigation. The sad thing is with the ethics investigation, we're probably not going to know what the outcome of that is before the election, which kind of leaves,
I think, December
17th. Yeah, leaves it hanging in the air, which is unfortunate because, I mean, it may turn out that Rod Blum didn't do anything wrong, but, I mean, that's, so.
I don't know if they're on par, but ethics violations are ethics violations. I mean, it's if you're going to commit ethics violations, that, is the problem. It's not whether it's a big ethics violation or a little ethics violation. It's an ethics violation. And it goes to the character.
My understanding is what Representative Finkenauer did, several legislators have done, where they fail to disclose some kind of asset. I'm way more concerned about the amount of special interest money and the amount of out-of-state money she's getting to her campaign. Her and J.D. Schulten in the 4th District are getting a very, very tiny amount of money from their districts, and you have to wonder if there's a lot of special interest money, a lot of wealthy people from out-of-state giving them money, then who do they ultimately answer to if they get to Washington, D.C.?
You know, perhaps it comes down to whether or not you convince some person on your staff to contribute to your ethics violation.
Why don't you explain what you're talking about, Linda?
Rod Blum, you know, in Tin Moon, that he had his chief of staff actually appear as a customer testimonial to Tin Moon, who could review and remove your FDA violations.
How big of a deal is disclosure becoming? I feel like we hear quite a bit more about that, about whether people have fully disclosed all their interests.
You know, I think the public is realizing that they know very little about the people who are representing them, even after they've elected them. And what they want to be able to do is they want to be able to judge where those conflicts of interest are. So I think it's valid, and especially, you know, given, you know, Rod Blum's reaction when all of this came out, that he was under attack and it was Hiroshima or whatever it was, that, you know, he just really blew this out of proportion. You know, you could just say, well, you know, I made a mistake, I'm very sorry, here's what happened. But that doesn't seem to be the reaction. It seems like the reaction was far out of par with what the allegation was. And that makes you wonder what more was within the allegation that we don't know about.
I'd like to zoom out from Iowa's 1st District to the race between Abby Finkenauer and Rod Blum. There's a Libertarian in that race, right?
No one has seen him or heard from him, is my understanding. No, but seriously, the Libertarians ran candidates in as many races as they could this year. Some of them have been really active. We've talked about Jake Porter. I think everyone up here admires the campaign he's running. Some of them have been really weird and far out there, and some of them have been pretty much missing in action. So,
I wanted to zoom out from the 1st District to talk about Iowa's congressional districts in the bigger picture of the national picture of the Democrats perhaps regaining the House. How does Iowa fit in there, our specific districts? The 1st District, probably seen as the most competitive, the one that the Democrats hope to flip along with the 3rd, right? How do you evaluate that as we are less than a month away from the November 6th midterm elections?
Well, the 1st District has been rated like the number one most likely to flip from Republican to Democratic control for months or longer. And it probably still is pretty dicey for Rod Blum. But one thing about that district is, you know, he wasn't supposed to win in 2014 and he won. He wasn't supposed to win 2 years ago and he won. And the most recent polling shows that it's basically a dead heat. And so, you know, once again, it's kind of, the cycle is repeating itself, it appears. I guess we won't know until November 6th, but I think it's probably too soon to call that race. The 3rd District, yeah, that's another one that people see as possible flipping. The 4th District seems like a bridge too far, even though some polling is showing it in single digits. To flip that district, I think it's probably, even with Bernie Sanders coming in and doing events for J.D. Schulten, it's probably not going to flip.
I understand why those are hot.
Dave Lobsack's safe, I think.
I understand why 1st and 3rd District are hot races, but I think it really coarsens our discourse, and I don't think it's very fun for anyone when we do become those national epicenter races. You see all of this outside money. You see a lot of negativity. So, you know, it's fun to be in competitive races. I'm glad that, you know, we're having this very broad discourse, but it also gets kind of ugly, and I will not be sad when this election is over.
So we've come to the end of our time together again, and I wanted to circle back to where we started this week. Earlier this week, the president visited Iowa, the other side of Iowa, Council Bluffs. And for our panel to leave you with this question, The last two times Donald Trump has visited Iowa, he has been the bearer of gifts. Not too long ago, he had a $12 billion aid package for farmers. Now this week, he announced E15 year-round ethanol. The question for you is, what gift will Donald Trump bear the next time he comes, and for whom? Adam Sullivan.
I think he's going to come tell us he's getting rid of presidential term limits. It's a gift to everyone.
That would be huge.
I think given his trade policies and the impact it's having on Iowa farmers, he's going to be giving coupons for those stoves that burn corn.
I think maybe he's going to come back and have a new issue from the Supreme Court that says corn likes beer. I'm at a loss. I don't know.
I have it on good authority that if Rod Blum wins on election night, we're getting a water park. We're getting a water park. See, they follow the casino saga, so they sort of know what I'm talking about.
Right. That ends this edition of Pints and Politics. Aaron and Jordan, thanks for co-hosting with me. Let's thank our panel. Woo!
And that winds up another Pints and Politics here on River to River, recorded yesterday evening at CSPS in Cedar Rapids. Our producer and audio editor today, Caitlin Harrop. Sound engineer, Jim Davies. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend.